up my chest. I hadn't gone far before I realized that the reception I got wasn't what I thought it would be. People began to stop and stare. Some even snickered. I couldn't understand why they were staring. Surely it couldn't be at the two beautiful hound pups sticking out of the gunny sack. Thinking that maybe I had a hole in the seat of my britches, I looked over to my reflection in a plate-glass window. I craned my neck for a better view of my rear. I could see a patch there all right and a few threadbare spots, but no whiteness was showing through. I figured that the people were just jealous because they didn't have two good hounds. I saw a drunk coming. He was staggering all over the street. Just as he was passing me, I heard him stop. As I looked back, I saw he was staring wide-eyed at my sack. Closing his eyes, he rubbed them with his hands. Opening them again, he stared. Shaking his head, he staggered on down the street. All around, people began to roar with laughter. Someone shouted, "What's the matter, John? You seeing things today?" I hurried on, wanting to get away from the stares and the snickers. It wouldn't have happened again in 100 years, but there they came. The same two old women I had met before. We stopped and had another glaring fight. One said, "I declare." The other one snorted, "Well, I never." My face burned. I couldn't take any more. After all, a man can stand so much and no more. In a loud voice, I said, "You may have these people fooled with those expensive-looking feathers in your hats, but I know what they are. They're goose feathers painted with iodine." One started to say something, but her words were drowned out by the roaring laughter from all around. Gathering up their long skirts, they swooshed on down the street. All around me, people began to shout questions and laugh. One wanted to know if I had the mother in the sack. Storekeepers stepped out and gawked. I could see the end of the street, but it looked as if it were 100 miles away. My face was as red as a fox's tail. I ducked my head, tightened my grip on the sack, and walked on. I don't know where they came from, but like chickens coming home to roost, they flocked around me. Most of them were about my age. Some were a little bigger, some smaller. They ganged around me, screaming and yelling. They started clapping their hands and chanting, "The dog boy has come to town, the dog boy has come to town." My heart burst. Tears came rolling. The day I had waited for so long had turned black and ugly. The leader of the gang was about my size. He had a dirty, freckled face, and his two front teeth were missing. I suppose he had lost them in a back-alley fight. His shock of yellow, sunburnt hair bobbed up and down as he skipped and jumped to the rhythm of the dog boy's song. He wore a pair of cowboy boots. They were two sizes too big for him, no doubt handed down by an older brother. He stomped on my right foot. I looked down and saw a drop of blood ooze out from under the broken nail. It hurt like the dickens, but I gritted my teeth and walked on. Freckleface pulled the ear of my little girl pup. I heard her painful cry. That was too much. I hadn't worked 2 long, hard years for my pups to have some freckle-faced punk pull their ears. Swinging the sack from my shoulder, I walked over and set it down in a doorway. As I turned around to face the mob, I doubled up my fist and took a Jack Dempsey stance. Freckleface said, "So you want to fight?" He came in swinging. I reached way back in Arkansas somewhere. By the time my fist had traveled all the way down to the Cherokee Strip, there was a lot of power behind it. Smack on the end of Freck's nose, it exploded. With a loud grunt, he sat down in the dusty street. Grabbing his nose in both hands, he started rocking and moaning. I saw the blood squeeze out between his fingers. Another one sailed in. He didn't want to fight. He wanted to wrestle. He stuck a finger in my mouth. I ground down. Shaking his hand and yelling like the hoot owls were after him, he ran across the street. Another one bored in. I aimed for his eye, but my aim was a little low. It caught him in the Adam's apple. A sick look came over his face. Bending over, croaking like a bullfrog that had been caught by a water moccasin, he started going around in a circle. But there were too many of them. By sheer weight and numbers, they pulled me down. I managed to twist over on my stomach and buried my face in my arms. I could feel them beating and kicking my body. All at once, the beating stopped. I heard loud cries from the gang. Turning over on my back, I was just in time to see the big marshal plant a number 12 boot in the seat of the last kid. I just knew I was next. I wondered if he'd kick me while I was down. I lay where I was. He started toward me. I closed my eyes. I felt a hand as big as an anvil clamp on my shoulder. I thought, he's going to stand me up and then knock me down. He raised me to a sitting position. His deep, friendly voice said, are you all right, son? I opened my eyes. There was a smile on his wide, rugged face. In a choking voice, I said, yes, sir, I'm all right. He helped me to my feet. His big hands started brushing the dust from my clothes.
Those kids are pretty tough, son, he said, but they're really not bad. They'll grow up someday.
Marshal, I said, I wouldn't have fought them, but they pulled my pup's ears. He looked over to my sack. One pup had worked its way almost out through the hole. The other one's head and two little paws were sticking out. Both of them were whimpering. A smile spread all over the big marshal's face.
So that's what started the fight, he said.
Walking over, he knelt down and started petting the pups.
They're fine-looking dogs, he said. Where'd you get them?
I told him I'd ordered them from Kentucky.
What'd they cost you?
He asked. $40, I said. He asked if my father had bought them for me. No, I said. I bought them myself. He asked me where I got the money. I worked and saved it, I said.
Takes a long time to save $40, he said.
Yes, I said. Took me 2 years.
2 years, he exclaimed.
I saw an outraged look come over the marshal's face. Reaching up, he pushed his hat back. He glanced up and down the street. I heard him mutter,
there's not a one in that bunch with that kind of grit.
Picking up my sack, I said, thanks for helping me out. I guess I'd better be heading for home. He asked where I lived. I said, up the river away.
Well, you got time for a bottle of pop before you go, haven't you?
I started to say no, but looking at his big friendly smile, I smiled back and said, I guess I have. Walking into a general store, the marshal went over to a large red box and pulled back the lid. He asked what kind I wanted. I'd never had a bottle of pop in my life and didn't know what to say. Seeing my hesitation, he said,
this strawberry looks pretty good.
I said that would be fine. The cool pop felt wonderful to my hot, dry throat. My dark little world had brightened up again. I had my pups and had found a wonderful friend. I knew that the stories I had heard about marshals weren't true. Never again would I be scared when I saw one. Back out on the street, I shook hands with the marshal, saying as I did, if you're ever up in my part of the country, come over and see me. You can find our place by asking at my grandfather's store.
Store?
He asked.
Why, the only store upriver is about 30 miles from here.
Yes, I said, that's my grandpa's place. He asked if I was afoot. Yes, I said.
Well, you won't make it tonight, he said, will you?
No, I said. I intend to camp out somewhere. I saw he was bothered. I'll be all right, I said. I'm not scared of the mountains. He looked at me and at my pups. Taking off his hat, he scratched his head. Chuckling deep down in his barrel-like chest, he said,
yes, I guess you will be all right. Well, goodbye, and good luck. If you're ever in town again, look me up.
From far down the street, I looked back. The marshal was still standing where I had left him. He waved his hand. I waved back. On the outskirts of town, I stopped and picked up a can and my provisions. I hadn't gone far before I realized that I had undertaken a tough job. The sack became heavier and heavier. For a while, my pups cried and whimpered. They had long since pulled their heads back in the sack. I would peek in at them every once in a while. They were doing all right. Curled up into two little round balls on my bundles, they were fast asleep. Deep in the heart of the Sparrowhawk Mountains, night overtook me. There, in a cave with a stream close by, I put up for the night. Taking my pups and bundles from the gunny sack, I used it to gather leaves to make us a bed. My pups followed me on every trip, whimpering and crying, tumbling and falling over sticks and rocks. After the bed was made, I built a fire. In a can of water from the mountain stream, I boiled 3 eggs. Next, I boiled half of the remaining salt pork. Cutting the meat up in small pieces, I fed it to my pups. Each of us had a piece of candy for dessert. My pups enjoyed the candy. With their needle-sharp teeth, they gnawed and worried with it until it was melted away. While they were busy playing, I dragged up several large timbers and built a fire which would last for hours. In a short time, the cave grew warm and comfortable from the heat. The leaves were soft and felt good to my tired body and sore feet. As I lay stretched out, my pups crawled all over me. I played with them. They would waddle up to the front of the cave, look at the fire, and come scampering back to roll and play in the soft leaves. I noticed the boy dog was much larger than the girl dog. He was a deeper red in color. His chest was broad and solid. His puppy muscles knotted and rippled under the velvety skin. He was different in every way. He would go closer to the fire. I saw right away he was bold and aggressive. Once he went around the fire and ventured out into the darkness. I waited to see if he would come back. He came wobbling to the mouth of the cave, but hesitated there. He made several attempts to come back, but the flames were leaping higher by the minute. The space between the fire and the wall of the cave was much hotter than when he had ventured out. Whimpering and crying, he kept trying to get around the fire. I said not a word, just watched. Puppy though he was, he did something which brought a smile to my face. Getting as close as he could to the side of the cave, he turned his rear to the fire. Hopping sideways, yipping at every jump, he made it through the heat and sailed into the pile of leaves. He had had enough. Curling up in a ball close to me, he went to sleep. The girl pup was small and timid. Her legs and body were short. Her head was small and delicate. She must have been a runt in the litter. I didn't have to look twice to see that what she lacked in power she made up in brains. She was a much smarter dog than the boy dog, more sure of herself, more cautious. I knew when the trail became tough, she would be the one to unravel it. I knew I had a wonderful combination. In my dogs, I had not only the power, but the brains along with it. I was a tired boy. My legs were stiff and my feet sore and throbbing. My shoulders were red and raw from the weight of the sack. I covered my pups up in the leaves and moved my body as close to them as I could. I knew as night wore on and the fire died down, the chill would come. Tired but happy, I fell asleep. Along in the silent hours of night, I was awakened. I opened my eyes but didn't move. I lay and listened, trying to figure out what it was that had aroused me. At first I thought one of my pups had awakened me by moving and whimpering. I discarded this thought, for I could see that they were both fast asleep. I decided it was my imagination working. My fire had burned down, leaving only a glowing red body of coals. The cave was dark and silent. Chill from the night had crept in. I was on the point of getting up to rebuild my fire when I heard what had awakened me. At first I thought it was a woman screaming. I listened. My heart began to pound. I could feel the strain all over my body as nerves grew tighter and tighter. It came again, closer this time. The high pitch of the scream shattered the silence of the quiet night. The sound seemed to be all around us. It screamed its way into the cave and rang like a blacksmith's anvil against the rock walls. The blood froze in my veins. I was terrified. Although I had never heard one, I knew what it was. It was the scream of a mountain lion. The big cat screamed again. Leaves boiled and stirred where my pups were. In the reflection of the glowing coals, I could see that one was sitting up. It was the boy dog. A leaf had become entangled in the fuzzy hair of a floppy ear. The ear flicked. The leaf dropped. Again the hellish scream rang out over the mountains. Leaves flew as my pup left the bed. I jumped up and tried to call him back. Reaching the mouth of the cave, he stopped. Raising his small red head high in the air, he bawled his challenge to the devil cat. The maul must have scared him as much as it had startled me. He came tearing back. The tiny hairs on his back were standing on end. My father had told me lions were scared of fire. I started throwing on more wood. I was glad I'd dragged up a good supply while making camp. Hearing a noise from the bed, I looked back. The girl pup, hearing the commotion, had gotten up and joined the boy dog. They were sitting side by side with their bodies stiff and rigid, their beady little eyes bored into the darkness beyond the cave. The moist tips of their little black noses wiggled and twisted as if trying to catch a scent. What I saw in my pups gave me courage. My knees quit shaking and my heart stopped pounding. I figured the lion had scented my pups. The more I thought about anything harming them, the madder I got. I was ready to die for my dogs. Every time the big cat screamed, the boy dog would run to the mouth of the cave and bawl back at him. I started whooping and throwing rocks down the mountainside, hoping to scare the lion away. Through the long hours of the night, I kept this up. The lion prowled around us, screaming and growling, first on the right, then on the left, and above and below. In the wee hours of morning, he gave up. and left to stalk other parts of the mountains. I'm sure he thought he didn't stand a chance against two vicious hounds and a big hunter. After the terrifying night, the bright morning sun was a welcome sight. I fixed breakfast, and soon we were on our way. I tried to get the pups to follow me so as to lighten my load. They would, for a way, and then, sitting down on their rears, they would cry and whimper. Back in the sack they would go, with their heads sticking out of the holes and their long ears flopping. I moved on. About midday I entered country I knew. I wasn't far from home. I dropped down out of the mountains into the bottoms, far above the place I had crossed the river on my way to town. Staying on the left of the river, I followed its course past several campgrounds, but didn't stop until I came to the one where I had found the magazine. Here I took the pups out of the sack and sat down in the warm sand. As the afternoon wore on, I sat there deep in thought. I was trying to think what I was going to tell my mother and father. I could think of nothing. Finally, I decided I would just tell them the truth, and with the help of the new overalls, cloth, and candy, I would weather the storm. My pups were having a big time playing. With their little front paws locked around each other, they were growling, rolling, and chewing on one another. They looked so cute, I laughed out loud. While I was watching their romping, the thought came, I haven't named them. I went over the list of names. For him, I tried Red, Bugle, Lead, name after name as before. For her, I tried Susie, Mabel, Queen, all kinds of girl names. None seemed to fit. Still mumbling names over and over, I glanced up. There, carved in the white bark of a sycamore tree, was a large heart. In the center of the heart were two names, Dan and Anne. The name Dan was a little larger than Anne. It was wide and bold. The scar stood out more. The name Anne was small, neat, and even. I stared, unbelieving, for there were my names. They were perfect. I walked over and picked up my pups. Looking at him, I said, "Your name is Dan. I call you Old Dan." Looking at her, I said, "Your name, little girl, is Anne. I call you Little Anne." It was then I realized it was all too perfect. Here in this fisherman's camp, I had found the magazine and the ad. I looked over at the old sycamore log. There I had asked God to help me get two hound pups. There were the pups, rolling and playing in the warm sand. I thought of the old KC baking powder can and the fishermen, how freely they had given their nickels and dimes. I looked up again to the names carved in the tree. Yes, it was all there like a large puzzle. Piece by piece, each fit perfectly, until the puzzle was complete. It could not have happened without the help of an unseen power. I stayed at the campground until dark. I knew I had to go home, but I put it off as long as I could. The crying of the pups telling me they were hungry made up my mind for me. I knew the time had come for me to face my mother and father. I sacked up my dogs and waded the river. As I came out of the bottoms, I could see the lamplight glow from the windows of our home. One of the small yellow squares darkened for an instant. Someone had walked across the floor. I wondered who it was. I heard Daisy, our milk cow, moo. I was thinking so hard of what I would say, it startled me for a second. Reaching the gate to our house, I stopped. I had never thought our home very pretty, but that night it looked different. It looked clean and neat and peaceful, nestled there in the foothills of the Ozarks. Yes, on that night I was proud of our home. My bare feet made no noise as I crossed the porch. With my free hand I reached and pulled the leather that worked the latch. Slowly the door swung inward. I couldn't see my father or sisters, they were too far to the right of me, but my mother was directly in front of the door, sitting in her old cane-bottom rocker, knitting. She looked up. I saw all the worry and grief leave her eyes. Her head bowed down, the knitting in her hands came up to cover her face. I stepped inside the room. I wanted to run to her and comfort her and tell her how sorry I was for all the worry and grief I had caused her. The booming voice of my father shook me from my trance. He said, "Well, what have you got there?" Laughing, he got up from his chair and came over to me. He reached and took the sack from my shoulder.
"When we started looking for you," he said, "I went to the store, and your grandpa told me all about it. It wasn't too hard to figure out what you had done, but you should have told us."
I ran to my mother, and dropping to my knees, I buried my face in her lap. As Mama patted my head, I heard her say in a quavering voice, "Oh, why didn't you tell us? Why?" I couldn't answer. Between sobs, I heard the squeals of delight from my sisters as they fondled my pups. I heard my father say,
"What's this other stuff you've got?"
Without raising my head from my mother's lap, in a choking voice I said,
"One is for you, one is for Mama, and the other's for the girls."
I heard the snapping of string and the rattle of paper. The ohs and ahs from my sisters were wonderful to hear. Papa came over to Mama. Laying the cloth on the arm of her chair, he said,
"Well, you've been wanting a new dress. Here's enough cloth to make half a dozen dresses."
Realizing that everything was forgiven, I stood up and dried my eyes. Papa was pleased with his new overalls. My sisters forgot the pups for the candy. The light that was shining from my mother's eyes as she fingered the cheap cotton cloth was something I will never forget. Mama warmed some milk for the pups. They drank until their little tummies were tight and round. As I ate, Papa sat down at the table and started talking man talk to me. He asked,
"How are things in town?"
I told him it was boiling with people. The wagon yard was full of wagons and teams. He asked if I had seen anyone I knew. I told him I hadn't, but the station master had asked about him. He asked me where I had spent the night. I told him about the cave in the Sparrowhawk Mountains. He said that must have been the one called Robber's Cave. My youngest sister piped up,
"Did you stay all night with some robbers?"
My older sister said,
"Silly, that was a long time ago. There aren't any robbers there now."
The other one put her nickel's worth in.
"Weren't you scared?"
"No," I said. "I wasn't scared of staying in the cave. But I heard a mountain lion scream, and it scared me half to death."
"Oh, they won't bother you," Papa said. "You had a fire, didn't you?"
I said, "Yes."
He said, "They'll never bother you unless they are wounded or cornered. But if they are, you had better look out."
Papa asked me how I liked town. I said I didn't like it at all and wouldn't live there even if they gave it to me. With a querying look on his face, he said,
"I'm afraid I don't understand. I thought you always wanted to go to town."
"I did," I said, "but I don't anymore. I don't like the people there, and couldn't understand them."
"What was wrong with them?" he asked.
I told him how they had stared at me, and had even laughed and made fun of me. He said,
"Oh, I don't think they were making fun of you, were they?"
"Yes, they were," I said, "and to beat it, all the boys jumped on me and knocked me down in the dirt. If it hadn't been for the marshal, I would have taken a beating." Papa said,
"So you met the marshal. What'd you think of him?"
I told him he was a nice man. He had bought me a bottle of soda pop. At the mention of soda pop, the blue eyes of my sisters opened wide. They started firing questions at me, wanting to know what color it was and what it tasted like. I told him it was strawberry, and it bubbled and tickled when I drank it, and it made me burp. The eager questions of my three little sisters had had an effect on my father and mother. Papa said,
"Billy, I don't want you to feel badly about the people in town. I don't think they were poking fun at you. Anyway, not like you think they were."
"Maybe they weren't," I said, "but I still don't want to ever live in town. It's too crowded, and you couldn't get a breath of fresh air."
In a sober voice, my father said, "Some day, you may have to live in town. Your mother and I don't intend to live in these hills all our lives. It's no place to raise a family. Man's children should have an education. They should get out and see the world and meet people."
"I don't see why we have to move to town to get an education," I said. "Hasn't Mama taught us how to read and write?"
"There's more to an education than just reading and writing," Papa said. "Much more."
I asked him when he thought we'd be moving to town.
"Well, it'll be some time yet," he said. "We don't have the money now, but I'm hoping someday we will."
From the stove where she was heating salt water for my feet, Mama said in a low voice, "I pray every day and night for that day to come. I don't want you children to grow up without an education, not even knowing what a bottle of soda pop is, or ever seeing the inside of a schoolhouse. I don't think I could stand that. I'll just keep praying and someday the good Lord may answer my prayer."
I told my mother I had seen the schoolhouse in town. Again, I had to answer 1,000 questions for my sisters. I told them it was made of red brick and was bigger than Grandpa's store, a lot bigger.
There must have been at least 1,000 kids going to school there. I told all about the teeter-totters, the swings made out of log chains, the funny-looking pipe that ran up the side of the building, and how I had climbed up in it and slid out like the other kids. I didn't tell them how I came out. "I think that was a fire escape," Papa said.
"Fire escape," I said. "Looked like a slide to me."
"Did you notice where it made that bend up at the top?" he asked. I nodded my head. "Well, inside the school, there's a door," he said. "If the school gets on fire, they open the door. The children jump in the pipe and slide out to safety."
"Boy, that's a keen way of getting out of a fire," I said.
"Well, it's getting late," Papa said. "We'll talk about this some other time. We better get to bed, as we have a lot of work to do tomorrow."
My pups were put in the corn crib for the night. I covered them with shucks and kissed them good night.
The next day was a busy one for me.
With the hampering help of my sisters, I made the little doghouse. Papa cut the ends off his check lines and gave them to me for collars. With painstaking care, deep in the tough leather, I scratched the name Old Dan on one and Little Ann on the other. With a nail and a rock, two holes were punched in each end of the straps. I put them around their small necks and laced the ends together with baling wire. That evening, I had a talk with my mother. I told her about praying for the two pups, about the magazine and the plans I had made. I told her how hard I had tried to find names for them, and how strange it was finding them carved in the bark of a sycamore tree. With a smile on her face, she asked, "Do you believe God heard your prayer and helped you?"
"Yes, Mama," I said. "I know he did, and I'll always be thankful."
It seems that the worries and wants of a young boy never cease. Now that I had my pups, another obstacle had cropped up. This one looked absolutely impossible. I had to have a coonskin so I could train them. With my three little traps and a bulldog determination, I set out to trap Mr. Ringtail. For 3 solid weeks, I practically lived on the river. I tried every trick I knew. It was no use. I just couldn't catch the wily old coons. In desperation, I went to my grandfather. He smiled as he listened to my tale of woe.
"Well, we'll have to do something about that," he said. "To train those dogs right, you need that coon hide, that's for sure. Now, you watch the store while I go over to my tool shed. I'll be right back."
After what seemed like an eternity, I saw him coming. He was carrying a brace and bit, that was all. With a mischievous little smile on his face, he said,
"You wouldn't think a fellow could catch a coon with this brace and bit, would you?"
I thought he was kidding me, and it made me feel bad.
"Why, Grandpa," I said, "you couldn't catch a coon in a jillion years with that thing. You just don't have any idea how smart they are."
"Yes, you can," he said. "You bet your boots you can. Why, when I was a boy, I caught coons on top of coons with one of these things."
I saw Grandpa was serious, and I got interested. He laid the brace down on the counter, picked up a small paper sack, and filled it about half full of horseshoe nails.
"Now, you do everything exactly as I tell you," he said, "and you'll catch that coon."
"Yes, sir, Grandpa," I said. "I will. I'll do anything to catch one of them."
"Now, the first thing you'll need is some bright objects," he said. "The best thing is bright, shiny tin. Cut out some little round pieces, a little smaller than this bit. You understand?"
I nodded my head.
"Now," he said, "you go down along the river where there are a lot of coon tracks. Find a good solid log close by and bore a hole down about 6 inches. Drop one of the bright pieces of tin down in the hole and be sure it's laying right on the bottom."
I was all ears. I didn't want to miss one word my grandfather said. Now and then I would glance at him to see if he was kidding me. In a serious voice, he went on talking.
"Now pay close attention," he said, "because this is the main part of the trap."
With eyes as big as hoot owls, I looked and listened. He took 4 of the horseshoe nails from the sack. With the thumb and forefinger of his left hand, he made a small O about the size of the bit, which was 1.5 inches in diameter.
"Now, we'll say this is the hole you bored in the log," he said. "About 1 inch apart, drive these nails in on a slant opposite each other."
Holding one of the nails in his right hand, he showed me the right angle.
The ends of the nails will enter the hole about halfway between the top and the piece of tin, he continued. Leave an opening between the sharp points big enough for a coon to get his paw through.
He asked me if I understood. Again, I nodded my head and moved a little closer to him.
How is that going to catch a coon, Grandpa? I asked.
It'll catch him all right, he said, and it won't fail. You see, a coon is a curious little animal. Anything that is bright and shiny attracts him. He will reach in and pick it up. When his paw closes on the bright object, it balls up, and when he starts to pull it from the hole, the sharp ends of the nails will gouge into his paw, and he's caught.
He looked over at me.
Well, what do you think of it? He asked.
I closed my eyes, and in my mind I could see the funnel-like entrance of the hole and the sharp slanting points of the nails. I could see the coon reaching in for the shiny piece of metal. Naturally, his paw would be much larger when closed than it was when he reached in. It would be impossible for it to pass the sharp nails. It was all looking pretty good to me, and I was on the point of saying so when it hit me. All the coon had to do was open his paw, drop the object, and he was free. It all blew up then and there. I just knew my grandfather was playing a joke on me. I stepped back and almost cried as I said, "Grandpa, you're kidding me. That kind of a trap couldn't catch a coon. Why, all he'd have to do is open his paw, drop the piece of tin, and he could pull it from the hole."
Grandpa started roaring with laughter.
This did make me feel bad. With tears in my eyes, I started for the door.
"Wait a minute," Grandpa said. "I'm not kidding you. Oh, I know I like to have my joke same as any man, but I meant every word I said."
I turned around and looked at him. He had stopped laughing, and there was a hurt expression on his face.
"I wasn't laughing at you," he said. "I was laughing more at myself than you. I just wanted to see if you were smart enough to see that there was a way the coon could free himself."
"A fellow wouldn't have to be very smart to see that," I said. Grandpa started talking seriously again.
"You know," he said, "a coon has more than one peculiarity about him. When I was a boy, I had a pet coon. By watching him, I saw and learned a lot of things. He had a den in an old hollow tree in our front yard. I don't know the number of times I'd have to climb that tree and get my mother's scissors, buttons, needles, and thimble from his den. Why, he'd even carry out our knives, forks, and spoons. Anything that was bright and shiny, he took to his den."
Grandpa stopped talking for a few minutes. I could see a faraway look in his eyes. Once again, he was living in those long-ago days. I waited in silence for him to go on with his story.
"One of the most peculiar things about that coon," he said, "was his front feet. Once he wrapped those little paws around something, he would never let go. My mother had an old churn. It was one of those kind with a small hole in the lid for the dasher. When she would get through churning, she would take the dasher out to wash it.
That crazy coon would climb up on top of the churn, poke his little front paw through the hole, and get a fistful of butter.
The hole was small, and when he closed his paw, he couldn't get it back out. All he had to do was open it, drop the butter, and he would be free. But do you think he would? No, sir. He would carry that churn lid all over the house, squalling and growling. Why, it took everyone in the house to free him. I'd have to wrap him up in a gunny sack or an old coat and pry his claws loose from the butter. Seeing this time after time is what gave me the idea for this trap. Once he reaches in and gets hold of that tin, he's caught because he will never open his paw."
With my confidence restored, it all sounded pretty good to me, and I was anxious to try out this wonderful plan. I thanked him, and taking the brace and nails, I left the store. By the time I reached home, it was too late in the day to start making my traps. That night, I talked the idea over with Papa.
"Yeah, I've heard of coons being caught that way," he said, "but I never paid much attention to it. Your grandfather should know, though, for he was quite a coon hunter when he was a boy."
"From what he told me," I said, "it never fails." Papa asked if I wanted him to help make my traps. "No," I said, "I think I can do it myself." I didn't sleep too well that night. I bored holes, drove nails, and fought coons practically all night. Early the next morning, I went to the trash pile. As I stirred around in the rusty old cans, I thought of another time I had searched for a can. Finally, I found the one I wanted. It was bright and shiny. Everything was going along just fine until Mama caught me cutting out the circles of tin with her scissors. I always swore she could find the biggest switches of any woman in the Ozarks. That time she overdid it. I was almost to the river before the stinging stopped. It wasn't hard to find places for my traps. All along the river, large sycamore logs lay partly submerged in the clear blue water. On one, where I could see the muddy little tracks of the ringtails, I bored a hole, dropped in a piece of tin, and drove my nails. On down the river I went, making my traps. I stopped when I ran out of nails. Altogether, I had 14 traps. That night, Papa asked me how I was making out. "Oh, all right," I said. "I've got 14 of them made." He laughed and said, "Well, you can't ever tell. You may catch one." The next morning, I was up with the chickens. I took my pups with me, as I just knew I'd have a big ringtail trapped, and I wanted them to see it. I was a disappointed boy when I peeked out of a canebrake at my last trap and didn't see a coon. All the way home, I tried to figure out what I had done wrong. I went to Papa. He put his thinking cap on and thought the situation over. "Maybe you left too much scent around when you made those traps," he said. "If you did, it'll take a while for it to go away. Now, I wouldn't get too impatient. I'm pretty sure you'll catch one sooner or later." Papa's words perked me up just like air does a deflated inner tube. He was right. I had simply left too much scent around my traps. All I had to do was wait until it disappeared, and I'd have my coon hide. Morning after morning, it was the same old disappointment. No coon. When a week had gone by and still no results from my traps, I gave up. What little patience I had was completely gone. I was firmly convinced that coons didn't walk on sycamore logs anymore, and bright, shiny objects had about as much effect on them as a coon hound would. One morning, I didn't get up to run my trap line. I stayed in bed. What was the use? It was just a waste of time. When the family sat down to breakfast, I heard my oldest sister say, "Mama, isn't Billy going to get up for breakfast?" "Why, is he in his room?" Mama asked. "I didn't know. I thought he was down looking at his traps." I heard Papa say, "I'll go wake him up." He came to the door and said, "You better get up, Billy. Breakfast is ready." "I don't want any breakfast," I said. "I'm not hungry." Papa took one look at me and saw I had a bad case of the ringtail blues. He came over and sat down on the bed. "What's the matter?" he asked. "You having coon trouble?"
"Grandpa lied to me, Papa," I said. "I should have known better. Whoever heard of anyone catching a coon with a brace and a bit and a few horseshoe nails?"
"I wouldn't say that," Papa said. "I don't think your grandpa deliberately lied to you. Besides, I've heard of coons being caught that way."
"Well, I don't think I've done anything wrong," I said. "I've done everything exactly as he said, and I haven't caught one yet."
"I still think it's that scent," Papa said.
"You know, someone told me, or I read it somewhere, that it takes about a week for scent to die away. How long has it been since you made those traps?" "It's been over a week," I said.
"Well, the way I figure, it's about time for you to catch one. Yes, I wouldn't be surprised if you came in with one any day now."
After Papa had left the room, I lay thinking of what he had said. Any day now. I got up and hurried into my clothes. As soon as I was finished with breakfast, I called my pups and lit out for the river. The first trap was empty. So was the second one. That old feeling of doubt came over me again. I thought, it's no use, I'll never catch one, and I so need the skin to train my pups. On the way to my third trap, I had to walk through a thick stand of wild cane. It was tough going, and my pups started whimpering. I stopped and picked them up. "We'll be out of this in a few minutes," I said, "and then you'll be all right." I came plowing out of the matted mass and was right on the trap before I realized it. I was met by a loud squall. I was so surprised I dropped the pups. There he was, my first coon. He was humped up on the sycamore log, growling and showing his teeth. He kept jerking his front paw, which was jammed deep in the hole I had bored. He was trapped by his own curiosity.
I couldn't move, and I felt like my wind had been cut off. I kept hearing a noise, but couldn't make out what it was. The movement of the boy pup shook me from my trance. The unidentified sound was his bawling. He was trying to climb up on the log and get to the coon. I yelled at him and darted in to get hold of his collar. On seeing my movement, the coon let out another squall. It scared me half to death. I froze in my tracks and started yelling again at my pup. The girl pup worked around behind the coon and climbed up on the log. I screamed at her. She paid no attention to me. Digging his sharp little claws in the bark, the boy pup made it to the top. He didn't hesitate. Straight down that sycamore log he charged. With teeth bared, the coon waited. When my pup was about 2 feet from him, he made a lunge. The coon just seemed to pull my pup up under his stomach and went to work with tooth and claw. The girl pup saved him. Like a cat in a corn crib, she sneaked in from behind and sank her needle-sharp teeth in the coon's back. It was too much for old Ringy. He turned the boy pup loose, turned around, and slapped her clear off the log. She came running to me, yelping her head off. I grabbed her up in my arms and looked for the boy pup. When the coon had turned him loose, he too had fallen off the log. He was trying to get back to the coon. I darted in and grabbed him by the hind leg. With the pup under each arm and running as fast as I could, I lit out for the house. Coming out of the bottoms into a fresh plowed field, I set my pups down so I could get a little more speed. I started yelling as soon as I came inside of the house. Mama came flying out with my sisters right behind her. Papa was out by the barn harnessing his team. Mama yelled something to him about a snake. He dropped the harness, jumped over the rail fence, and in a long lope started for me. Mama reached me first. She grabbed me and shouted, "Where did it bite you?"
"Bite me?" I said. "Why, Mama, I'm not bit. I've got him. Mama, I've got him."
"Got what?" Mama asked.
"A big coon," I said. "The biggest one in the river bottoms. He's this big, Mama."
I made a circle with my arms as big as a 20-gallon keg. Mama just groaned way down deep and covered her face with her hands. Some big tears squeezed out between her fingers. Almost in a whisper, I heard her say,
"Thank God, I thought you were snake-bitten."
My sister, seeing Mama crying, puckered up and started bawling.
"He needs a whipping," the oldest one said. "That's what he needs, scaring Mama that way."
Something busted loose inside me, and I cried a little, too.
"I didn't mean to scare Mama," I sniffed. "I just wanted everyone to know I caught a coon."
Up until this time, Papa hadn't said a word. He just stood looking on. "Here now," he said. "Let's have none of this crying. He didn't mean to scare anyone."
Taking his handkerchief from his pocket, he stepped over to Mama, put his arm around her, and started drying her eyes. Mama poked her head around him and glared at me.
"Billy Coleman," she shouted, "if you ever scare me like that again, I'll take a switch and wear you to a frazzle."
This hurt my feelings, and I really did get tuned up.
"Everyone's mad at me," I said, "and I haven't done anything but catch the biggest coon on the river."
Mama came over.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't mean to be cross, but you did scare me. I thought a rattlesnake had bitten you."
"Now that that's all settled," Papa said, "we had better go get that coon."
Looking at Mama, he said,
"Why don't you and the girls go with us? I don't think it'll take long."
Mama looked at me, smiled, and turned to the girls.
"Would you like to go?" she asked.
Their only answer was a lot of squealing and jumping up and down.
On the way, Mama noticed some blood on my shirt. She stopped me and started looking me over.
"Where did that come from?" she asked. "Did that coon bite you?"
"No, Mama," I said. "I didn't get close enough for him to bite me."
With a worried look on her face, she jerked out my shirt.
"You don't seem to be scratched anywhere," she said. "Maybe this is where it came from," Papa said.
He reached down and picked up my boy pup. His little black nose was split wide open and was bleeding. I saw a relieved look come over Mama's face. Looking at me, she started shaking her head.
"I don't know," she said. "I just don't know."
"Did that coon get hold of this pup?" Papa asked.
"He sure did, Papa," I said. "But it wasn't the coon's fault. If it hadn't been for little Ann, he'd have eaten him up."
I told how my dogs had tied into the coon. Papa laughed as he fondled my pup.
"This dog is going to be a coon hound," he said, "and I mean a good one."
The coon started squalling as soon as we came in sight.
"My goodness," Mama said. "You wouldn't think anything so small would be so vicious."
Papa picked up a club. "Now, everybody stand back out of the way," he said. "This won't take long."
My pups were wanting to get to the coon so badly that they were hard to hold. I had to squeeze them up tight to keep them from jumping right out of my arms. My sisters, with eyes as big as blue marbles, got behind Mama and peeked around her. Papa whacked the coon a good one across the head. He let out a loud squall, growled, and showed his teeth. He tried hard to get to Papa, but the trap held him. The girls buried their faces in Mama's dress and started bawling. Mama turned her back on the fight. I heard her say, "I wish we hadn't come, poor thing." Papa whacked him again, and it was all over. It was too much for Mama and the girls. They left. I heard the tall cane rattling as they ran for the house. After the coon was killed, I walked over. Papa was trying to get the coon's paw from the trap. He couldn't do it. Taking a pair of pliers from his pocket, he said, "It's a good thing I had these along, or we would have had to cut his foot off." After Papa had pulled the nails, he lifted the coon's paw from the hole. There, clamped firmly in it, was the bright piece of tin. In a low voice, Papa said, "Well, I'll be darned." All he had to do was open it up, and he was free. But he wouldn't do it. Your grandfather was right. A sorrowful look came over Papa's face as he ran his fingers through the soft yellow hair. "Billy," he said, "I want you to take a hammer and pull the nails from every one of those traps. It's summertime now, and their fur isn't any good. Besides, I don't think this is very sportsmanlike. The coon doesn't have a chance. It's all right this time. You needed this one. But from now on, I want you to catch them with your dogs. That way they have a 50-50 chance."
"I will, Papa," I said. "That's what I intended to do."
While we were skinning the coon, Papa asked me when I was going to start training my dogs.
"I don't know," I said. "Do you think they're too young?"
"No, I don't think so," he said. "I've heard that the younger they are, the better it is."
"Well, in that case," I said, "I'll start tomorrow."
With the help of my oldest sister, we started giving my pups their first lessons. She would hold their collars while I made trails with the hide for them to follow. I'd climb trees that leaned out over the river, jump out into the water, swim to the other side, and make trails up and down the bank. With a long pole and wire, I'd drag the hide on top of rail fences, swing it through the air, and let it touch the ground 20 or 30 feet away. I did everything with that hide a coon would do, and probably a lot of things a coon couldn't do. It was a beautiful sight to see my pups work those trails. At first they were awkward and didn't know what to do, but they would never quit trying. Old Dan would get so eager and excited he would overrun a trail. Where it twisted or turned, he would run straight on, bawling up a storm. It didn't take him long to realize that a smart old coon didn't always run in a straight line. Little Ann never overran a trail. She would wiggle and twist, cry and whine, and pretty soon she would figure it out. At first they were afraid of water. I never would admit it even to myself. I always said that they just didn't like to get wet. They would follow the trail to the stream and stop. Sitting down on their rears, they would cry and beg for help. With a pup under each arm, I'd wade out into the stream and set them down in the cool water. 9 times out of 10, one pup would swim one way and the other one would go just the opposite way. I had a time with this part of their training, but my persistence had no bounds. It wasn't long until they loved the water. Old Dan would jump as far out as he could and practically knock the river dry. Little Ann would ease herself in and swim like a muskrat for the opposite shore. I taught my dogs every trick I knew and any new ones I heard about. I taught them how to split up on a riverbank to search for the hidden trail because of the water. Old Dan would jump as far out as he could and practically knock the river dry. Little Ann would ease herself in and swim like a muskrat for the opposite shore. I taught my dogs every trick I knew and any new ones I heard about. I taught them how to split up on a riverbank to search for the hidden trail, because it was impossible to tell where a coon would come out of the water. Sometimes he might swim downstream, and other times he might swim upstream. Maybe he would come back to the bank he had just left, or he would cross over to the other side. Perhaps he would stop in the middle of the stream on an old drift. Sometimes he would come out of the water by catching the dangling limbs of a leaning birch and climbing up, never touching the bank. Or he could come out on the same trail he used to go in and backtrack.
He would sometimes crawl up under an undermined bank or into an old muskrat den. One of the favorite tricks of a smart old ringtail is the tree barking trick. This he accomplished by running far up on the side of a tree and using his stout legs for leverage, springing 20 or 30 feet away before touching the ground. Dumb hounds trail up to the tree and start bawling treed. I taught my dogs to circle for a good 100 yards to be sure he was still in the tree before bawling. In order to learn more about coon hunting, I'd hang around my grandfather's store and listen to the stories told by the coon hunters. Some of the tales I heard were long and tall, but I believed them all. I could always tell when Grandpa was kidding me by the twinkle in his eyes. He told me how a coon could climb right up the fog and disappear in the stars, and how he could leap on a horse's back and run him over your dogs. I didn't care, for I loved to hear the tall tales. Anything that had a coon hair in it, I believed completely. All through that summer and into the late fall, the training went on. Although I was worn down to a frazzle, I was a happy boy. I figured I was ready for the ringtails. Late one evening, tired and exhausted, I sat down by a big sycamore and called my dogs to me. "It's all over," I said. "There'll be no more lessons. I've worked hard, and I've done my best. From now on, it's all up to you. Hunting season is just a few days away, and I'm going to let you rest, for I want you to be in good shape the night it opens." It was wonderful indeed how I could have heart-to-heart talks with my dogs, and they always seemed to understand. Each question I asked was answered in their own doggish way. Although they couldn't talk in my terms, they had a language of their own that was easy to understand. Sometimes I would see the answer in their eyes, and again it would be in the friendly wagging of their tails. Other times I could hear the answer in a low whine or feel it in the soft caress of a warm, flicking tongue. In some way, they would always answer. The day hunting season opened, I was as nervous as Sammy, our house cat. Part of that seemingly endless day was spent getting things ready for the coming night. I cleaned my lantern and filled it full of oil. With hog lard, I greased my boots until they were as soft as a hummingbird's nest. I was grinding my axe when Papa came around. He smiled as he said, "This is a big night, isn't it?"
"It sure is, Papa," I said, "and I've waited a long time for it."
"Yes, I know," he said. "I've been thinking. There's not too much to do around here during the hunting season. I'm pretty sure I can take care of things, so you just go ahead and hunt all you want to."
"Thanks, Papa," I said. "I guess I'll be out pretty late at night, and I'll probably have to do a lot of sleeping in the daytime."
Papa started frowning. "You know," he said, "your mother doesn't like this hunting of yours very much. She's worried about you being out all by yourself."
"I can't see why Mama has to worry," I said. "Haven't I been roaming the woods ever since I was big enough to walk? And I'm almost 14 now."
"I know," said Papa. "It's all right with me, but women are a little different than men. They worry more. Now, just to be on the safe side, I think it would be a good idea for you to tell us where you'll be hunting. And if anything happens, we'll know where to look."
I told him I would, but I didn't think anything was going to happen. After Papa had left, I started thinking. He doesn't even talk to me like I was a boy anymore. He talks to me like I was a man. These wonderful thoughts made me feel just about as big as our old red mule.
I had a good talk with my dogs.
"I've waited almost 3 years for this night," I said, "and it hasn't been easy. I've taught you everything I know, and I want you to do your best."
Little Anne acted like she understood. She whined and saved me a wash job on my face. Old Dan may have, but he didn't act like it. He just lay there in the sunshine, all stretched out and limber as a rag. During supper, Mama asked me where I was going to hunt.
"I'm not going far," I said, "just down on the river."
I could tell Mama was worried, and it didn't make me feel too good.
"Billy," she said, "I don't approve of this hunting. But it looks like I can't say no, not after all you've been through getting your dogs and all the training."
"Oh, he'll be all right," Papa said. "Besides, he's getting to be a good-sized man now."
"Man?" Mama exclaimed. "Why, he's still just a little boy.
You can't keep him a little boy always, Papa said. He's got to grow up someday.
I know, Mama said, but I don't like it, not at all, and I can't help worrying. Mama, please don't worry about me, I said. I'll be all right. Why, I've been all over these hills, you know that. I know, she said, but that was in the daytime. I never worried too much when it was daylight, but at night, that's different. It'll be dark, and anything could happen. There won't be anything happen, I said. I promise I'll be careful.
Mama got up from the table, saying, Well,
it's like I said. I can't say no, and I can't help worrying. I'll pray every night you're out.
The way Mama had me feeling, I didn't know whether to go hunting or not. Papa must have sensed how I felt. It's dark now, he said, and I understand those coons start stirring pretty early. You had better be going, hadn't you?
While Mama was bundling me up, Papa lit my lantern. He handed it to me, saying,
I'd like to see a big coon skin on the smokehouse wall in the morning.
The whole family followed me out on the porch. There we all got a surprise. My dogs were sitting on the steps, waiting for me. I heard Papa laugh.
Why, they know you're going hunting, he said. Know it as well as anything.
Well, I never, said Mama. Do you really think they do? It does look like they do. Why, just look at them.
Little Ann started wiggling and twisting. Old Dan trotted out to the gate, stopped, turned around, and looked at me.
Sure, they know Billy's going hunting, piped the little one, and I know why. How do you know so much, silly? Asked the oldest one. Because I told Little Ann, that's why, she said, and she told old Dan. That's how they know.
We all had to laugh at her.
The last thing I heard as I left the house was the voice of my mother.
Be careful, Billy, she said, and don't stay out late.
It was a beautiful night, still and frosty. A big, grinning Ozark moon had the countryside bathed in a soft yellow glow. The starlit heaven reminded me of a large blue umbrella outspread and with the handle broken off. Just before I reached the timber, I called my dogs to me.
Now, the trail will be a little different tonight, I whispered. It won't be a hide dragged on the ground. It'll be the real thing. So, remember everything I taught you, and I'm depending on you. Just put one up a tree, and I'll do the rest.
I turned them loose, saying,
Go get 'em!
They streaked for the timber. By the time I had reached the river, every nerve in my body was drawn up as tight as a fiddle string. Big-eyed and with ears open, I walked on, stopping now and then to listen. The way I was slipping along, anyone would have thought I was trying to slip up on a coon myself.
I had never seen a night so peaceful and still. All around me, tall sycamores gleamed like white streamers in the moonlight.
A prowling skunk came wobbling up the riverbank. He stopped when he saw me. I smiled at the foxfire glow of his small beady red eyes. He turned and disappeared in the underbrush. I heard a sharp snap and a feathery rustle in some brush close by. A small rodent started squealing in agony. A nighthawk had found his supper. Across the river and from far back in the rugged mountains, I heard the baying of a hound. I wondered if it was the same one I had heard from my window on those nights so long ago. Although my eyes were seeing the wonders of the night, my ears were ever alert, listening for the sound of my hounds telling me they had found a trail. I was expecting one of them to bawl, but when it came, it startled me. The deep tones of old Dan's voice jarred the silence around me. I dropped my axe and almost dropped my lantern. A strange feeling came over me. I took a deep breath and threw back my head to give the call of the hunter. But something went wrong. My throat felt like it had been tied in a knot. I swallowed a couple of times and the knot disappeared. As loud as I could, I whooped, Hoo-wee! Get him, Dan, get him! Little Ann came in. The bell-like tones of her voice made shivers run up and down my spine. I whooped to her, Hoo-wee! Tell it to him, little girl, tell it to him! This was what I had prayed for, worked for, and sweated for. My own little hounds bawling on the trail of a river coon. I don't know why I cried, but I did. While the tears rolled, I whooped again and again. They straightened the trail out and headed downriver. I took off after them as fast as I could run. A mile downstream, the coon pulled his first trick. I could tell by my dog's voices that they had lost the trail. When I came to them, they were out on an old drift, sniffing around. The coon had pulled a simple trick.